Okay. All right. This week's Sedra is Parshas Korach. And of course, Korach leads a rebellion against Moshe Rabbeinu. And ostensibly, he's speaking in the name of the Tzibur, the name of the Jewish people, Kaleitha Kulam Goshim, that the whole nation is holy, Besochem Hashem. In other words, he's advocating a populist revolt, but everything should be based on what the people want. It's a little bit like the Animal Farm. All animals are equal. They're just those that are more equal to others. Korach might have advocated publicly his populist revolt, but in truth, the matter, he was seeking leadership for himself. And then, in a sense, there is the episode of many in Korach's camp are swallowed up by the earth. And others who were Maktira Haktoris, they were burnt. A fire came down and burnt them. And the Jewish people were overcome with fear, seeing what happened to those that were involved in the revolt against Moshe and Aaron. And they ran away. But the next day, Vayihi Machras, and we'll get into it, they all gathered together again against Moshe and say, Atem Hamitem Esam Hashem. You destroyed the nation of God. It's your fault that the camp of Korah was swallowed up. Never mind that Korach led a rebellion against you, and in doing so, a rebellion against HaKadosh Baruch Hu, against God. Never mind that they were going against the command from heaven that Aaron HaKohen should be the leader of those serving in the Beis HaMikdash. But it's all your fault. And God tells, in order to demonstrate, not just for that generation, but for future generations as well, that Shevet Levi was the chosen Shevet for the Beis HaMikdash. So God tells Moshe to take the staff of the leaders of every tribe and to put it in the Mishkan. And among the staffs was the staff of Aaron HaKohen. And the staff that will bud, have flowers, that's the staff of the chosen tribe. And the next day, when they took a look, it was the staff of Aaron that budded, that had flowers, that had almonds on it. And the question is, what was the symbolic meaning of this sign? Yes, the staff was taken and was put inside the Mishkan, inside the Kodesh Kedoshim, by the Aron, by the Ark, for future generations to see. The staff is today in the lower chambers of the Beis HaMikdash, right underneath the area where it was, where the Aron was in the Beis HaMikdash when it was on the normal level. Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, when he made the Beis HaMikdash, he made a lower chamber just underneath where the Aron was in the Beis HaMikdash. That when it becomes necessary to hide the Aron, when it comes necessary to put the Aron away, to ensure that the Aron will not be taken to exile. So there should be a place in the Beis HaMikdash, in a sense, for the Aron to remain. And together with the Aron was the Tzinsenes Haman, the jar, if you want, with the head contained a sampling of the man, and of course the staff of Aaron with its budding, with its flowers, with its fruit, all attached to it as a symbol for future generations. The man is a symbol how God takes care of the sustenance of the Jewish people, how he took care of the sustenance of the Jewish people in the desert when they're doing on their trip from Mitzrayim and from Sinai to Eretz Yisrael, actually from Egypt. The man came earlier. And it also had the Mata Aron, the staff of Aron. So future generations should know that Shevet Levi was the chosen. But what was the symbol of the idea of taking a staff? Of taking a staff. And for this test. Now, my father suggested that the idea behind the staff of Aaron and the staff of the other Nasiim, of the prince of every tribe, that was placed overnight in the Mishkan. The purpose was to explain, just to show that Shevet Levi was the chosen Shevet, but to show why Shevet Levi was chosen. Now, my father said, a staff? What is a staff? A staff is a piece of wood, not connected to the ground at all. And all of a sudden, the staff is budding with flowers and with fruit. What's the idea? The idea is that for something to grow, it has to be connected to the ground. It's get its nourishment, so to say, from the ground. The agricultural process takes place because it's planted in the ground. A staff is cut off from the ground. There are those who are planted in the proper environment, they can bud. They can produce flowers, spiritual flowers, even spiritual fruit. But when they're not in that proper environment, when they're not planted in an environment in the ground that will provide them the opportunity, the normal opportunities that allows agricultural growth, then it can't produce fruit. It can't produce floods, flowers. It can't produce budding. And what is true about plants, for the most part, is very often, unfortunately, true about individuals. For individuals, and this is an idea that I've stressed over and over, they're people who can grow within a given environment. I mentioned the Meraglim. When they left Moshe, so long as they were Moshe, Rosh Ebenei Yisrael Haima, they were leaders of the people. Kulanam Anashim. They were all, Rashi says, Anashim Tzadikim. But the moment they were in a different environment, an environment that did not lend itself to spirituality, so they made a rebellion against HaKadosh Baruch Hu, against God, and against Moshe. And my father would say, explain the pasuk, Kat Tzadik HaTomei Yifrach, the Tzadik grows like a palm tree. What does it mean that the Tzadik grows like a palm tree? My father said, where do you see palm trees? You tend to see palm trees in the desert. In other words, the tzaddik isn't one who blossoms in an environment that's conducive to blossoming. Tzaddik is one who can blossom in a spiritual desert as well. And that was the message. You know why Shevet Levi was chosen for service to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Because Shevet Levi had this ability to overcome the environment, where they will be in an environment that was not conducive to service to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So because of that, they were chosen to be the servants of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the Beis HaMikdash and in the Mishkan. At the time of the Egel HaZav, when the Jewish people, in a sense, formed a mob against HaKadosh Baruch Hu, only 40 days before they were stood at Maamar Har Sinai. But the environment changed with Moshe Rabbeinu being gone for 40 days. Because the environment changed, they acquiesced to the idolatry, to the celebration of the idolatry. And this, but Shevet Levi, on the contrary, separated itself at that moment from the rest of Klal Yisrael. And when Moshe came down, they became Moshe's aid in undoing the damage that was perpetrated by those who made the Egel HaZav, those who made the golden calf. They were like a staff. They were cut off from the ground. But nevertheless, they budded. They produced flowers and they produced fruit. And the truth of the matter is, my father would always mention that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu chose Abraham in Parshas Lech Lecha, He says, "Vaheye bracha, you will be a bracha. You will be a bracha." What does it mean? You will be a bracha. What it means, you will be a bracha, that Avram will be the symbol of a blessing. As Rashi tells us, when someone wants to bless his son, he'll say, "Heye Kavram, be like Avram." And we find a similar thing in regard to the bracha that Yaakov gave Ephraim and Manasseh. B'cha yivarech Yisrael leimor, Yisimcha lekim k'Ephraim u'Manasseh. In other words, Ephraim and Manasseh will become the symbol of bracha. When the Jewish people bless their children, they will say, "You should be like Ephraim and Manasseh." So it seems that Ephraim and Manasseh on one hand and Avraham on the other hand have something in common, that they're both appointed as the symbol of bracha. My father said, what did they have in common? Echad hay Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu was one person. He was called Avraham Ivri. The whole world is on one side and he's on the other side. Avram, perhaps more than any of the Avos, and perhaps even more than any other Jew, was the person who went out and talking to the whole world, introducing the world to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Nevertheless, we say, Avram Ivri, the whole world on one side and Avram on the other side. That means that Avram was able to resist the negative influences of the people, with the multitudes of people that he had contact with. And Menashe and Ephraim, where were they brought up? They were not brought up in Eretz Yisrael. They were not brought up in the tent of Yaakov, together with their cousins, the sons of the other Shvatim. They were brought up in Egypt, the center of idolatry, the center of immorality. The Torah warns us against imitating the ways of Egypt. The environment of Egypt had an impact on almost everybody who came in contact with it. But Menashe and Ephraim, it's true, they were brought up in the house of Yosef. But as we all know, and especially when you're part of royalty, as Yosef was, Mishnah Lamelech, you're not influenced, just that the tendency is not just to be influenced within the walls of your house, but you're influenced by society, especially if you're part of the upper echelons of the society. And nevertheless, Menashe and Ephraim were able to remain tzaddikim. Asher nasan li Hashem bazeh, Yosef said, these are the ones that God gave to me in Egypt. They remained under the influence of Yosef, in spite of the general environment that they were in. So they too became the symbol of bracha, because that was the symbol of a tzaddik. And This, I think, this is what my father said was the symbol of the staff of Aaron budding. However, and what is the idea behind all of this? The idea behind all of this is that if you're part of a group, you have to be able to maintain your individuality. You have to be able to separate yourself from the group. If you come bottle to the group, if you lose your individuality, and you're not able to think for yourself, then we have mob psychology. It's become pretty common today that you see people breaking windows of stores, using any excuse. These people would never do it alone, because if it was something that they would be doing themselves, well, I shouldn't say, many of these people would not do it by themselves, because they don't want to be identified with criminality. But if it's the group, it's not me that's doing. It's those that want democracy that are doing it. To kill as an individual. To cause havoc as an individual. To destroy as an individual. Many have trouble doing it, although it's seeming to become less and less troublesome lately. But when I do it as part of a group, it's not me. It's the group that's doing it. So you have to be able to rise above the group. And in a sense, this was the bracha that Moshe gave Yoshua. HaKadosh Baruch Hu should save you from the plan of the Meraglim. What is the idea? The idea is that so long as Yoshua was in Moshe's tent, as I mentioned last week, so long as Yoshua was in Moshe's tent, there was no concern. But now he was leaving Moshe's tent. Now he had to be able to think for himself. Now he had to establish, as I said last week, his personal relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So Moshe was mispalo that Yoshua should work on himself, to develop this type of independent commitment to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And this is the idea of Levi. Shevet Levi was able to separate themselves. But I think there is another possible explanation for this. That is, there is a medrash in the Alka Chimoni. And I've mentioned this medrash before about Pelegish Begiva. By Pelegish Begiva, thousands upon thousands of Jews were killed in the civil war that went on between Binyamin and the other Shvatim. And the Medrash asks, what was not the immediate cause But what was the background cause that created an environment that led to the problem the Legish Begiva? And the Medrash says that the members of Sanhedrin, the High Court of Israel, the Torah leaders of the Jewish people, they should have gird their loins. They should have taken their staff, their walking stick. And one day, go to a different city. Management at Sipora. And other cities as well. Kedei lelameg leYisrael Torah v'derech eretz. To teach the Jewish people Torah and derech eretz. I'm sure there are those who are tempted to suggest that derech eretz means the study of Musar. The more likely explanation of derech eretz here, although I'm not considering that an impossibility as being included, but derech eretz probably means to look into the welfare of the people, to see if they're able to make a living, to teach them Torah and how to make a living. In other words, the job of the Dol Yisrael, the job of the leaders of the Jewish people, didn't end with a shir. Part of the job was enabling them to get provisions, to provide for themselves, to provide for their families, to get jobs. And of course, it goes without saying, to teach them Torah. And he says, Vahem lo asu kach. But the elders of the Bezdin at that time didn't do this. But each one sat down by his vineyard or his fig tree. He was concerned only about his own comfort. And the only involvement that they might have had with the people was when the people came to them. And that's a misrepresentation of what Jewish leadership is all about. The Jewish leader has to be ready to take the staff in his hand and to go from town to town, from city to city. Kedei lelameg liYisrael Torah v'derech eretz. In order to teach and inspire the Jewish people in Torah and in making a living. And it's because they didn't have this attitude that the whole episode, the Pelegish Begiva, took place. It's because ultimately, because of this, of what happened, that thousands upon thousands of Jews were killed in the civil war. And to a certain degree, Shevet Levi is the Shevet that doesn't even get a chelik in Eretz Yisrael, get a city spread around. Why didn't it get cities spread around all of Eretz Yisrael? The answer is, their portion wasn't to separate them from the rest of the Jewish people. On the contrary, they got portions to enable them to have contact with the other Jewish people. Because the lot of Shevet Levi is to go from place to place. And it's interesting. When Moshe Rabbeinu talks about the task of Shevet Levi, it's Yoru Mishpatech LeYaakov V'Sarasto LeYisrael Yosivu Torah Ba'Pecha V'Chol Amos Bechecha. It seems that their prime task, their prime mission, their prime challenge was teaching Torah. The secondary mission, the secondary challenge was the avoda. Teaching Torah had to be done by going from place to place. It's interesting, it's brought down that if for some reason the Talmud goes into Golos, so to a certain degree, Rabbi Goleimo, his teacher, goes with him, because the responsibility of teaching Torah doesn't end when the student walks out of the door. And to a large degree, that's part of the difference between the teacher perspective as it exists among Umos Olam, among the nations of the world, and the teacher perspective as it exists among the Jewish people. Now, it's very interesting that the Medrash says, the Pasuk says, Vayhi b'machras, and the day after God made this test of the leaders bringing their staff to Moshe, and the staff being placed overnight in the base, in the Mishkan. So, and the staff of Aaron budded. So the Torah says, "Vinei parach mat Aaron the base Levi." When Moshe Rabbeinu looked at the staff, it blossomed. Vayetze parach. It blossomed. Vayetze tzitz, it sprouted a bud. Vayigmol shkedim. It had ripened almonds. And as Rabbein Bechaye points out, it's not just telling us the order that the staff of what happened to the staff of Aaron. It's not just that it budded. It blossomed, then it budded, and then it had fruit. No, the staff showed all three things. And the question is, why was it necessary? Why was it necessary for the staff to show all three stages? Because usually, when Vayatzit sits, you don't see the blossom. And then when it's when it comes fruit, the other things disappear. But here, miraculously, all the stages were there on the staff of Aaron. How do we understand it? Now the Torah tells us by you, Chayi Sarah, the life of Sarah was Mea Shana Ve'esrim Shana Ve'sheva Shana. The life of Sarah was 100 years, 20 years, and 7 years. I'm going to say it the way Rashi says it. Ramban says a little different. So the question is, why does it say 100 years, 20 years, and 7 years? And it should have said 127 years. By the way, that's how Targum Unculus translates it. So the way Rashi cites the Medrash is to tell us that at the age of 20, Sarah was as beautiful as the age of 7. was to beauty like the age of 7. And at the age of 100, she was as clean from sin. They have to understand there are many sins that a person is not punished for until they reach the age of 20. Sins that are made at the age of 20 are treated more severely than sins made at a younger age, certain sins. So to a certain degree, 20, because of that, is identified with going from a period that is identified with innocence, going to a period that is not as identified with innocence. So when she was at 100 years old, she was like 20 in regard to innocence. What's the idea behind it? The idea behind it, as I've mentioned many times, is that each stage of a person's life has positive and negative traits. And when one goes from one stage of their life into another stage of their life, the traits of the previous stage somehow disappear. And they adopt new traits. The youth, the earlier stages is identified with one hand with youthfulness, with innocence. On the other hand, with immaturity. And then when you go to the next stage, very often the natural tendency is to lose that sense of innocence, to lose that sense of youthfulness. And on the other hand, to a certain degree, hopefully, you become more mature. But that is a person who's controlled by time. But a person who is in control of time, and specifically in control of their time, they're able to take the positive qualities of one stage of their life and bring it into the next stage of their life. In the case of Sari Menu, a girl at the age of 20 might be considered beautiful. And at the age of 7, she's also beautiful. But the beauty at the age of 7 comes jointly with a certain sense of innocence that's not always there with the beauty of a girl at the age of 20. So Sari Menu, being a master of time, being in control of her time, or if I could use the expression of another Medrash Rabba, Parshas Kaisar, who ruled over her time, who ruled over herself, and consequently ruled over her time, was able to take the positive qualities of one stage of life and bring it to the other stage. And while this is very true about character traits, it's important that this be applied not just to character traits, but to life experiences as well. We have to be able to take the impact of the experiences we had in an earlier part of our life and bring that into a later part. The Torah tells us that when Korach and his camp was swallowed up or burned up, Korach, the Medrash says, had both forms of death. So the people were overcome with fear and they ran away. But Vayihim Machras, it was the next day. And when we came the next day, Yulonu Kolam al Moshe Aaron. They gathered together. They became the mob once again. They didn't think as individuals. What was the first result of not thinking as individuals? And I'd like to suggest that there was a tendency when they formed the mob, when they formed the group. So, in a sense, that reminded them of their servitude. An individual slave has no worth. He's only worth as part of the group. A slave also is not a master of time. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says, Abde Hazman Heim Abadim La'Abadim Abde Hashem Heim Rak B'nei Chorin. The slaves of time are the slaves of slaves. The servants of God, they are truly free. Because to be a servant of God, one has to rule over himself. You become, your only identification is that you're part of a mob, you're part of a group, then you don't rule over yourself. So, Vayehi Mimachras, so yes, just yesterday, they ran away, they were overcome with fear. What happened? Vayehi Mimachras. It was the next day. The impact was gone. The past was gone. As Ibn Gabriel says, Ha'avarayin v'ha'asir adayin v'ha'ovek k'harifayin. The past is gone. You only have the fleeting moment of the present, and the future is not yet here. That's if one is not a master of time. That it's one if doesn't rule over time. But he lets time rule over him. And this was part of the problem. Part of the problem was the Jewish people at that time, at least, after Kriyas Shamsuf, time and time again, they're rising up in rebellion. But when they're rising up in rebellion, perhaps we could suggest, hey, they just came out of Egypt. They don't know what it means to rule over time. But in Ahimi Mafras, it's the next day. It's no longer, the present is gone. The experience of what happened to Korah for rebelling against God, against Moshe. That's also gone. The only thing they see, that in accordance with what Moshe said, Korah was swallowed up by the earth. So, in other words, they pick and choose. But the actual experience is not really there. And so the idea was, it wasn't just to demonstrate why Aaron was chosen. The purpose of taking the staffs and putting it into the Beis HaMikdash was for the people to understand that the past, the events that took place in the Midbar, had to be permanently part of them. When you take a look at the Aron that was put in the Kodesh Kedoshim, what was placed there together with the Aron, the Mun, the staff of Aron. Why? Because traversing the Midbar cannot be a forgotten experience. It has to be part of us. It's like the budding in our own staff. The past has to be part of the present. And in a sense, the Aron represents the bringing of Har Sinai, the Beis HaMikdash itself, is the idea, the Beis HaMikdash, the Mishkan. It's the bringing of the experience of Sinai to the future of Klal Yisrael. It's for this reason that the man and the staff was put next to the Aron. Because the Aron represents not only the taking of the Torah from place to place, but it represents taking the Torah from generation to generation as well. And the Jewish people had to understand that the past had to be part of their present. And that's why it was necessary for the staff of Aaron to be placed in the Beis HaMikdash, in the Mishkan, because that was the perpetuation, not just of Sinai, but the perpetuation of the experience of traversing the Midbar as well. But the message was not just a message about Shevet Levi. It was a message about what the Jewish people had to learn from the incident of Korach, from the incident of the staff. In other words, we cannot isolate the past from the present. Because if we forget, then we're isolating the past from the present. Part of the message was that we have to think as individuals. It's very interesting. The Torah tells us that Aaron ben Peles was part, initially, of the mob that rose up in revolt against Moshe and Aaron. But when the ultimate showdown, so to say, took place, Aaron ben Peles isn't there. It's Aaron ben Peles' wife. In her mind, she said, if Korach wins, if Moshe wins, my husband doesn't have a special position. It's true. And if Korach wins, she was able to understand that even though Korach was screaming, Kaleinu Kulam Goshem, the Sultan Hashem, she was able to understand that her husband was just being used, would be a nothing also. So she manipulated that her husband shouldn't come to the final showdown, so to say. And the question arises, why did Aaron ben Peles understand that himself? And the answer is, because Aaron ben Peles was part of the mob. And when you become part of the mob, you cease to think. You let the mob think for you. In a sense, the whole idea of the mob was part of Korach's plan. Question is, okay, Korach was interested in leadership. He was upset that he was not appointed as a leader for at least part of Shevet Levi. I mean, he went through the Midbar. He saw all the miracles. Korach was not a dumb person, it seems. Seems to have been a very capable person. We say Hakina v'Hataiva v'Hakovot. Mutzina sa'odim in olam. Jealousy, desire, and wanting high regard for oneself takes a person out of the world. What does it mean it takes a person out of the world? It means it gives man the ability to deny reality. So Korach for himself was able, because of his desire to be a leader. So Korach himself felt that it's worth making a rebellion. He should have understood, but that's the idea. Take him out of the world. But Omban Pelas, as his wife said, if Moshe wins, he's a nothing. If Korach wins, he's also a nothing. Why was it that Omban Pelas' wife was not overtaken by this idea of Kinatai Vavakavot, Motsinus Adam and Ola? The answer is, as the Medrash tells us, she was a lady of the tent. She was in her tent. And because she stayed in her tent, she was not part of the mob. Because she was part of them, she was not part of the mob. She was able to think as an individual. And when she thought of as an individual, she was able to come in contact. She was able to come in contact with reality. Korach, he was able to form the mob. Why did he form the mob? He formed the mob. Korach emphasizes the community. What did Korach think? What was his rationale? Okay, it's kinetaiba kavod matzina sadam and ola. But as my father would always say, in explaining many gemaras, the reason that there is a reason of why, and the reason of what. Why Korach acted this way? Kinetaiba kavod. Motsina Saga Manola. And because of that, the whole past was forgotten. But what was Korach? That's the why. But the what? How was he to explain? Says, I think the simple explanation is that Korach's attitude was not much different than many who are breaking off from Torah tradition today. Not much different from those who are trying to reinterpret the halacha in the same way. But many try to have this idea of reinterpreting the Constitution so it should accommodate their desires. I would talk, not saying who, I one time talked to some individual rabbis. And I said to them, I don't understand. What do you think? When you create special bati dinim, special bezdins, Yemoshech Roshei Sanhedrios. You appoint, but they didn't. And the Paskin, in manners that will make the people want to be closer with you, to identify with you, to associate with your movements. But don't you realize, long term, generations down the road, no one is going to want to marry these people or their children? You're not doing them any favors. In Europe, when a Rav paskin the Shaila, and there I'm talking Europe, they paskin sincerely. But when a Rav paskin the Shaila about whether someone is mutalova b'kol, whether somebody could be married, marry other Jews, so, very often, it was known perhaps in the individual town, and if they went into another town, no one knew about it. But today, the whole world is one small town. Whether it's because of the internet, everybody knows what's going in everybody's backyard. And when you point special, but they didn't, that use heterim, leniencies that are not part of the Mesorah. And even if sometimes you yourself are part of the Mesorah, but you use heterim leniencies, and even if you really think, and which in most cases they don't really think, that these leniencies are correct. But if most of the Jewish people don't accept these leniencies, down the road, people will not want to marry these people's children. You're not doing them a favor. Later on, it'll be much more difficult dealing with those shilas than it would be right now. So why are you doing all this? And the answer that Rabbi gave me says, listen, people are going to want to marry these people, and they will accept these leniencies. In other words, we're going to force a change in the halacha. The idea is, and they base it on all kinds of things. Minhag. Minhag plays a role in halacha. But only a minhag that it can be assumed was created because the poskim felt that thing. Minhag is only a proof that shita was accepted. Minhag doesn't become a heter in itself, a leniency in itself. There are those who identify as Orthodox rabbis, and they will say that even if something is generally accepted as being prohibited, if we get the people to do it, ultimately someone will find the heter, will find the leniency. And the unfortunate thing is that sometimes the way leniencies are given, that adds fuel to their argument. But ultimately, down the road, people will recognize what was a heter that was really based on Mesorah. And what was a heter that was created to deviate from the Masorah? And in a sense, that's what Korach was. Korach said, Kol ha'eta kulam doshim. The halacha is not the way Moshe says. Once Har Sinai took place, once God spoke to the people, so God, in a sense, gave the Torah over to the people. So the people could interpret the Torah in the way they want. And it's irrelevant. And as each generation takes place, what the previous generation understood becomes irrelevant. But we have to understand that the whole Torah is from Sinai. And we can't deviate from Sinai. The past is part of the present, and the present has to be part of the future. And what Korach wanted to do is to separate the past. And if the Matan Torah, the halach is what the people say, God is the prisoner of the Jewish people. And the Jewish people dictate what's the halacha. That was the cry of Korach. Korach was dedicated to the idea of mob psychology. And there are those, and he wanted to use mob psychology not only as a political tool, not only as a tool to get power, which he certainly tried to do, but he tries to use the mob to recreate the halakha. And this is something that we're still dealing with today. And this is, we have to, on one hand, we have to be able to withstand the influence of the mob. And the way to do it is to go out to the Jewish people. We have to be able to go from place to place to inspire the Jewish people to Limud HaTorah. But we have to understand that we have to take past, present, and future and put them together. Because that is the whole idea of Masorah. The idea of Masorah is the linkage of the past, the present, and future. Okay.
If anyone has any questions, please put them in the chat. Any questions?